United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Judge Allen, and I'm joined this morning by my colleagues, Judge Toth and Judge Falvey. We're convened today via video conference to consider arguments in the matter of William D. Cohen versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 20-6227. Would counsel for the parties, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance?
Mr. Carpenter and Linda Hurl appearing on behalf of Mr. Cohen.
Good morning, Mr. Carpenter.
Good morning, Your Honor. Alex Catroli and Deputy Chief Counsel Amanda Haddock for the Secretary.
And welcome to you both. Mr. Carpenter, I understand you want to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we've already got that set, and you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. William Cohen. Mr. Cohen's appeal presents two distinct issues, both of which require this Court to interpret the amended notice provisions of 38 U.S.C. 5104. The VA's January 18, 2019 notification to Mr. Cohen in its of its November 9, 2018 ramp decision was not compliant with the requirements of the statute. The Secretary asserts that the notification and the ratings decision together provide compliant notice. This assertion is erroneous and reads into the statute that the rating decision is part and parcel of the notice requirements. 5904 does not reference a VA does reference VA decisions twice, but does so only in the context of the reason that the notice is being provided.
Mr. Carpenter, I want to pause here for a second. So what do you make of the case law that, for instance, I think this Federal Circuit case called Mayfield, there's a couple others that sort of treat decisions as part of notice, that you can kind of read them in tandem to serve the notification requirements. What do you make of that case law?
I don't make anything of them because those decisions predated the amendment to 5104. And the reason that that's important is because of the substantial overhaul that Congress undertook to the adjudicatory appeal and appeal process, making fundamental changes in the way in which it proceeds, one of which is the specific content requirements of 5104 as amended. Those content requirements did not exist other than to provide a reason for the decision in the prior notice requirements. And therefore, any reference that is made in decisions such as Mayfield about whether or not a rating decision is or isn't part and parcel of the notice process has to be ignored because we're looking at a fundamental structural change that was made by Congress.
I mean, from a practical perspective, I mean, this would make the notification letter something like a second decision, right? I mean, it would have to include something of the depth of a lot of the material that would be in the decision itself.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that's the case at all. To the contrary, an examination of the specific content requirements outlined by Congress in 5104B clearly indicates that there is a process contemplated in which the Secretary will inform the claimant and his or her representative as to what the decision said as to these specific content areas. It is somewhat comparable to what was done previously under the statement of the case, but it is a process of notice that is specific in content and requires the Secretary to, independent from the decision, explain to the claimant and the claimant's representative what was done under these seven specific content requirements. So I would suggest, Your Honor, that Congress, in the fundamental changes that it made in the notice requirements is clearly separating any connectivity that might have existed previously between the rating decision and the notice, and clearly indicated that this is part of the informing process to claimants about what the options are that are available. And if one examines the content requirements through that lens, one is able to recognize that Congress was ensuring that claimants and their representatives would have the information necessary to make informed decisions about which of the options to exercise.
Mr. Carpenter, can you so summarily dismiss cases like Mayfield, that given that 5104A was unchanged and that, B describes the notice content requirements, but it's A that establishes the notice requirement.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that I am summarily dismissing it. To the contrary, I believe that it is something that now must be read in tandem with the provisions of A, and that it has clearly been added by Congress with the expectation that the Secretary is going to provide critical information to claimants and their representatives.
No doubt that that Congress intended additional information to be provided in the notice. But I mean, lawyers face the concept of incorporation by reference all the time, and there's a reason why it's permissible to do that in many contexts, and that is that it would be inefficient, duplicative, and potentially rife with potential scrivener's errors and things like that as you try to draw from the decision those aspects that you need to draw the recipient of the notice's attention to.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I believe that that's the wrong perspective to take.
Well, if informed choice is the important matter, don't you want to just make sure they've got the information in order to make that informed choice rather than building in inefficiencies that the AMA was intended to make the system more efficient, build in inefficiencies while we wait for some additional, I can't remember how you described it, but, an additional layer of review and incorporation of information into the actual body of the notice rather than relying on the information is provided in the attached.
Well, Your Honor, if the court please, I am trying to draw the court's attention to the fact that your analysis is premised upon an attorney reading that notice. I believe that Congress took the perspective that this notice requirement was not about a claimant reading it with the assistance of counsel, but with the claimant being the unsophisticated individual that is subject to the decisions of the secretary, which affect his or her benefits, and that the notice requirements are geared toward providing a understandable explanation to the pro se claimant with or without an advisor so that the claimant can make those informed decisions. Obviously, as an attorney, I am able to provide greater assistance to a claimant than the claimant trying to understand the notice that is being provided. But that's where the content of the notice becomes critical and distinguishable between what existed pre-amendment and what exists now that Congress has made these fundamental structural changes. That it is absolutely necessary that the pro se claimant be able to understand in plain language what the secretary decided as it relates to the seven specific content requirements that are identified by Congress.
I think I agree with you, but that doesn't mean that the notice can't be provided in the attached documents.
Well, of course it's provided in the attached documents, Your Honor. The difference is that one is an adjudicatory document, the decision, which deals with, if you will, the thumbs up or thumbs down on the claim. And it is supposed to provide reasons or bases for that decision, but reasons or bases are fundamentally different than the requirements set out in 5104B. The requirements set out in 5104B require that it be explained to the claimant what issues were adjudicated by identifying those issues. And with all due respect to the Secretary, and I've been doing this for quite some time, it is often extremely difficult to figure out precisely what the Secretary did in terms of which issues were adjudicated, because they're normally framed in a grant or a denial framework. What the first content requirement addresses is whether or not is to identify the specific issues adjudicated. And as we know or should know, issues can be different or within an individual claim. And the rating decision usually addresses with clarity the ultimate decision on the claim, but not necessarily a clarity of what issues they adjudicated to arrive at that ultimate decision.
So, Mr. Carpenter, I mean, do you have a proposed interpretation for that term, either a definition or, I mean, you can give us some examples.
I'm sorry, for which term, Your Honor?
The term issues.
Oh.
What does that mean?
Well, I think the term issues has to be defined broadly. And I don't believe the Secretary's current regulations do that with any degree of clarity. And if this court were to be so inclined, I would love to see a precedential decision in which this court does define the term issues at least as determined decided upon by this panel. So I would propose that the term issues includes in the language used in 5107, any material matter at issue. That would include not just the claim itself, whether the benefit is granted or not, but the issues in that claim, which, let's take for example in service connection, the three fundamental issues of current disability, incurrence in service, and a relationship between the two. Those three are issues within the claim. Also issues within the claim and service connection can be the statutory presumptions of either service connection or soundness or aggravation, which was an issue that was adjudicated by the Secretary in order to arrive at his decision in the matter that is the subject of the notice. Now, I don't know whether the court really would want me to.
Mr. Carpenter, could I ask you a question? It's slightly different than what we've been talking about. So are you aware if there has been a challenge at the Federal Circuit? I don't think there has been, but I just want to make sure I'm right, to 3.103F as part of the AMA regulation?
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I was thinking about another case about 3.304F. And I'm sorry. Yeah, no, Your Honor. There has not that I'm aware.
So then, in order for you to prevail here on the point, at least on the point about whether things have to be in the notice letter as opposed to the decision, okay?
Yes.
We would have to invalidate at least a few words in 3.103F, right? Because that says that written notification must include in the notice letter, and that it includes the following phrase, or enclosures or a combination thereof. And then it goes on to list the seven elements that are listed in the statute in subpart B. So we'd have to get rid of that, right? Because it seems to me that if that regulation is correct or permissible, we'll say under Chevron's term, right? Mm-hmm. If that's a permissible regulation, then if all of the elements were included in an enclosure, that would satisfy the regulation, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that there hadn't been a challenge out there yet, because I hadn't seen one, but.
Well, let me qualify my affirmative response. While my initial reaction is yes, that it could be done in enclosures, as a potential reasonable interpretation by the secretary of the provisions of 5104B, I'm not sure that's what Congress intended. It seems to me that by making reference to enclosures, it suggests that there is something other than the notice. Now, if the notice is the enclosure, I don't really have a problem with that. But if it's an attempt to distinguish notice from enclosures, I think I do have a problem with that, because I believe Congress's language is clear that the notice shall include.
Oh, I understand your argument, right? Okay. And so my point being, if one were to read 5104 A and B together, yes, to be absolutely clear that there is a notice and there is a decision, and the notice has to include these elements, then, you know, that's your argument. If, though, we were to say that there was either an ambiguity in the statute or a gap to be filled, then I think the secretary's position would be, we've promulgated subpart F of 3.103, which expounds on the fact that you can satisfy the statutory requirements in this way, right? And so if we concluded that the statute had a gap or was ambiguous, then we'd have to look at the regulation. And if we concluded that the regulation best read would be the notice can do what the statute says by including, by incorporation, enclosures, which would include the decision, right? Then if the regulation is okay and we read it that way, then in order for you to win, we'd have to get rid of the regulation, right? Or at least those words.
I see. I'm sorry. I missed that premise of the enclosure would be the rating decision to fulfill that obligation.
Well, I'm assuming it doesn't say it has to be the rating decision. And
well, no, I understand that.
Right.
But,
yeah.
But your hypothetical is premised upon the fact that the enclosure would be the rating decision, which would then meet the gap that was created by the statute.
Yes, I mean, right. I mean, because if in fact the enclosure that was referred to in the regulation was actually a separate document called notice as required by 5104B, right, then that would be consistent with your argument about the statute, basically.
Yeah.
I suspect that the secretary's position is, although Mr. Cutrelli can tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I think the secretary's position is we can satisfy 5104A, the last sentence of A and B, by putting things in the letter itself, but also including enclosures with the letter. Therefore, because the decision here included favorable findings, under the regulation, we now have satisfied 5104B4 because we have it in the decision, which can be incorporated into the letter.
Well, with this qualification, Your Honor, I don't believe that argument works in this case, because even though you may be able to extract from the rating decision favorable findings, I don't think you can extract any of the other, and I believe in this case it would be six of the seven content requirements in the notice that was provided in this case, and certainly in the second argument, which goes to the board's decision, there simply was nothing attached, and the secretary would not be able to say that the board decision somehow did that, since in our view it was bereft of any of the requirements under 5107B.
Yes, I'm with you, right? There might be problems with the notice provided, even if we, at the RO level, even if we can include the whole kit and caboodle, right?
Yes,
I'm just putting that to the side to figure out first this point about the letters. I have a related question, sort of, which is this. Assume we ruled in your favor that these type of letters, and so this, as far as I can determine, this is a form, meaning it wasn't a one-off that Mr. Cowan got this type of letter, but somebody else got different types of letters, right? So working under that assumption, if we were to hold in this case that the letter is deficient because it literally does not include all of the elements, leaving aside whether the elements are sufficiently articulated, they're not there, right? What would be the impact on decision letters that had been sent out to all of the other veterans?
They would all be defective. Yeah.
And I think that's right, I think. But then the impact would be those decisions would not
be final.
Be final, right? I just wanted to...
Yes.
Right, that doesn't answer the question. I just wanted to understand. Your answer answered my question. That doesn't go to the answer to the legal question we have. I just wanted to make sure we were on the same page about the impact of that decision.
I believe we are, Your Honor, and I believe that is why this case was called the panel, because it has profound implications. Now, fortunately, we are not too far into the administration, if you will, of the amended statute. And yes, while it probably covers literally millions of VA decisions, the actual impact would have to be discerned on a case-by-case basis by both the claimant and any counsel or representative that might advise them. But I think that's way beyond the purview of this court to deal with those ramifications. To me, this court is assembled today to simply interpret the plain language and, I believe, the unambiguous language of 5104, which says, without qualification, the notice shall include. That's mandatory language. That's not permissive. And inclusion is self-evident in its meaning. It must be included. And it must be separate and apart from the decision, both in this case, the RAMP decision, and later the board decision.
So, Mr. Cumberland, I want to ask about remedy and harm. The board exists to correct mistakes that the RO made, right? And presumably that would also include any errors in notice. So what should the board do and what's the harm exactly from a defective notice?
Well, in this case, the board could have corrected the notice problem in one of two ways. The first way would have been to make a finding that the decision was not ripe for review because it wasn't a final decision for which notice of disagreement could have been expressed, and sent it back for compliant notice. The other way that they could have remedied the notice defect by the RAMP decision would have been to do as we asked, to provide, to include, as required by 5104, these content requirements in a notice attached to its decision. And had they done that, that would have remedied any defect in this particular RAMP decision.
Meaning the board would submit that attachment, not the, not the RO.
Well, I'm saying I believe they had a choice of remedies. That remedy I explained in the first instance. In the alternative, I believe the remedy could have been, we acknowledge that the board did not provide notice, but since you have the remedy of filing a supplemental claim, then we will provide you the notice to our decision that will give you the information that you didn't get coming from the RAMP decision to the board.
Okay. And now what about post-board decision? Let's say the board addresses at least all of the issues in its reasons and bases in its decision that that maybe would have been covered by the notice, and then it arrives up to us. What's the harm and what's the remedy?
Well, I believe there's...
And before you answer, Mr. Carpenter, I'm just going to have Dawn at some time. Yeah, so, Dawn, if you can put 5 minutes on the clock. Go ahead, Mr. Carpenter.
Sure. I just want to correct what I think is a flaw in the premise that it is even possible for a board decision to include in its four corners the requirements of 5104B. They would have to radically structure their format to be able to do that. But I will assume for a moment that the possibility would exist for them to do that. I reject that as being consistent with the clear intent of Congress that this notice is to be provided separate from board decisions themselves, as I do for being separate from any agency level decision, whether that be on an initial claim, on a supplemental claim, on a higher level review decision, any of those that would happen within the new process, that any of those decisions would need to have separate and independent from any content within the rating decision, the specific content requirements set out in 5104B. And I recognize, Your Honor, that that is huge, that that is really massive in its import. But so is what Congress did when it wrote the AMA.
On that point, Mr. Carpenter, I just want to, I'm still thinking of consequences.
Yes.
And so I don't for a second mix that up with the substance, right? You know, chips fall where they may, those sort of things. But I'm sort of having flashbacks to the period of the court after the VCAA,
yes,
where everything went back. Because if you're right on both the RO and the board issues here, then, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be the necessary implication would be that we would have to send every AMA case back for compliant notice, right?
I believe that would be correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Right, that's what I, so.
But if I could qualify that, I think that the board, as I was speaking to Judge Toth, could correct that with notice and not rewriting the decision. In other words, the VCAA remands were interpreted at the time as requiring a complete do-over because they didn't provide notice in the first instance. But VCAA notice was at the front end, if you will, of the adjudicatory process. This notice is at the back end. It is when the decision has been written that this notice requirement exists and is imposed on the secretary, both in his agency level decision making and in his board decision making. So I don't really think it's quite as ominous. And I would add to that, Your Honor, that as we evolved in the VCAA remand flush, the bar recognized that there were certain circumstances in which waiver was appropriate. And this case in this court in Janssen approved the waiver of that notice so that the merits of the appeal could be addressed. And I think that remedy, with some modification, obviously would be available in this circumstance should the court rule in favor of Mr. Cowan's interpretation.
Judge Falvey, it looked like you had a question a while back, and I want to make sure you get to ask it.
I think it got covered. Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter, you can finish up.
Well, if I could, with this caveat that I may need more time if there are any questions that relate to the second issue, because these really are separate and distinct issues between whether the RAMP decision notice was compliant, period, versus whether the board is making a 511 decision of the secretary, and whether or not they are required to provide the notice that is set out in the regulation. If there are no questions on
I will ask a question. I'll have Dawn add two more minutes here. Just on that point. So here, it seems to me, and the secretary does the opposite of what I'm going to ascribe to you, right? Which is that you want to say at the RO level, don't worry about these pre-existing cases that say, like Mayfield, right? Because the world has changed, right? And the secretary's position is exactly the opposite. No, we got these earlier cases, they answer the question. But then when we get to the board level, you two take different positions, right? You say, well, wait, you've already said in these cases that a board decision is a decision of the secretary. And the secretary's position is, wait, the world has changed. So what do we do with that? I mean, I think the world has either changed or it hasn't.
Well, honestly, I'm not sure it has to be decided on those grounds. Mr. Cowan's reliance on Thompson is only to the point of what constitutes a decision, and that this court has examined that question. And there really isn't anything in the world that changed about whether a board decision was or wasn't a decision of the secretary. And clearly the Federal Circuit in Cummings, when it looked at the requirements of the notice that was being provided at that time by the board, did address that issue as a 511 decision of the secretary. So it seems to me that while there are some comparable aspects, I think at the end of the day, the secretary's position about the world having not changed is somewhat different, or at least nuanced, from the position that we're taking. And just one final thought, that's the art of advocacy, Your Honor. I mean, that are what we do.
Yes, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? As one said. Judge Toth, do you have any other questions?
I just have one. I mean, why would the notice that might apply to the board, why would it not be wholly duplicative of the decision itself? I mean, why wouldn't the board just print out the decision, change the title from board decision to notice, and then they would have satisfied their duty?
Well, they wouldn't have satisfied their duty by doing that, Your Honor, because the seven questions, if you will, that are required to be addressed in the notice are different than the decision made by the board. And this decision in this particular case is the perfect example. And I'm more than happy to go through exactly how that's different.
Yeah, I mean, how? The only one that I see that really would not be, I mean, the board has to discuss the issues they decide. They have to discuss the laws they decide. They have to discuss the evidence they consider. They have to discuss, I mean, these are just part and parcel of sufficient reasons and bases.
But forgive me, Your Honor, it's not about the board's discussion. That's what they do for the reasons and bases requirement within the decision. The notice requires, in order to be compliant, that the first content requirement is the identification of the issues adjudicated. And if you look at the board's order, it commingles a lot of things that they did in one rather horrific paragraph rather than doing it individually. What is required by the notice provision in 5104B1 is an identification of each issue adjudicated. In other words, what did you adjudicate? The how you adjudicated it is the reasons or basis. The second requirement of B is a summary of the evidence to be considered by the secretary. The board would have been required to provide a summary of the evidence, not a rehash of how they interpreted that evidence, but a summary of what specific evidence. And that's really important in trying to understand what a rating decision did or what a board decision did, which is left out of this process. And having been in this process for multiple decades, you must be a soothsayer in order to understand what evidence was relied upon by the agency or the board, because all they do at the agency level is list it, and all they do at the board is to make reference to it without identifying what specific document it is in the record, because we don't have a record that contains citable locations for the specific evidence. And the difference in the content requirement under B2 is very important, because the board would be required to summarize the evidence that they consider, not to make the assessment, but simply identify it as what they considered. We considered this VA examination. We considered this lay statement from the veteran. We considered this statement from another lay person that was in the record, so that each evidence, that each piece of evidence that was considered by the board was summarized. We understood that evidence to say. That to me is what Congress said in B2. And I can go through the rest of them, Your Honor, and if you have any specific questions about them, but I don't want to take any more time.
No, I think I understand your answer.
I think you got the gist of. Thank you.
Judge Falvey, do you have anything else?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. We'll restore your full rebuttal time. And Mr. Cottrelli, you can have as much time as you need, because we gave Mr. Carpenter extra time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honors, this case is about the proper interpretation of 38 U.S.C. Section 5104 as amended by the AMA, whether certain notice letters were required to and did comply with Section 5104. This court should affirm the board decision for three main reasons. First, the January 2019 AOJ notice letter satisfied all the requirements of Section 5104. Second, the May 2020 board decision notice letter was not required to comply with Section 5104 because Congress did not intend for the section to apply to the board. And third, even if there is some ambiguity in Section 5104, the Secretary's interpretation is reasonable and supported by legislative history and other statutes and regulations. Moving to my first point, Your Honor, the January 2019 notice letter with enclosures was 5104 compliant. As Judge Falvey...
Mr. Cottrelli, I just want to get one thing off the table to begin with. So you would agree that if the notice and the decision are treated as separate documents, okay, meaning that the portion of the regulation that allows the incorporation of stuff, enclosures in order to satisfy the notice requirement, the notice letter concerning the rating decision doesn't comply, right? If we just looked at that document, it doesn't comply.
If I understood your question correctly, Your Honor, I believe that's not correct. We believe
So tell me then, looking just at the notice letter, just the letter, how would a person ever be able to know that a favorable finding was made? Can you point me to something in this letter? I'm going to give you a little bit of advice, Mr. Cottrelli. You don't have to die on this hill, right? Because there's nothing in the notice letter. But my point is, your argument depends on us reading the decision in conjunction with the letter, doesn't it?
It does, Your Honor. But the case law and this court's precedent and Federal Circuit precedent allows for that. In fact, as Judge Falvey noted, Mayfield and even Cummings v. West, which was cited by appellant in this case, specifically state that notice letters or notices have never just required the notice letter. In fact,
absolutely. We're going to get there. I'm going in baby steps, right? So the first step is there's no argument that the letter itself contains all of the arguments in 5104B. That doesn't mean the secretary loses, right? It just takes one way the secretary can win off the table. But if you actually do want to say, no, that letter is itself compliant, I then would explore that with you. I'm just trying to figure out whether you agree that the elements in 5104B just aren't in the letter alone.
We believe that the notice letter does contain some of the contents, Your Honor, but they also incorporate the contents by
reference. Let me stop you. Okay. I confess to you, I'm not at all certain why this is hard. Okay. I understand advocates don't ever like to give something up, right? But you cannot point me to anything in the letter itself that, just picking one example, says anything about favorable findings, right?
Just looking at the notice letter, Your Honor, it likely does not satisfy all of the contents of Section 5104B.
What do you mean by likely? Seriously, Mr. Cottrelli, I don't understand why you're spending so much time on this. Is there anything is the secretary's position that if we just looked at the letter, just the letter, we could say it is compliant with the eight things in 5104, because there's one thing at the end of subsection A that talks about appellate rights, and then this list of seven in subsection B, right? I had understood the secretary's position that we have complied with that because you look at the letter and all the enclosures, including the rating decision, to make sure that they're all there. If in fact the secretary's position is, no, we can go along with Mr. Carpenter, it's all in the notice letter, then you should tell me that clearly, right?
To answer your question, Your Honor, no. The notice letter does not specifically outline all the different requirements of Section 5104B, but as I believe Judge Falvey noted, they are incorporated by reference, and the rating decision is provided as an enclosure with the notice letter.
So that's right. So then, it seems to me there are two paths by which the secretary prevails, at least leaving aside whether the stuff in the rating decision satisfies, right? I'm just talking about this threshold question. One is we are bound by Mayfield or some other prior judicial decision, right? Or regardless of that, right, 3.103F is a permissible interpretation of 5104A. Do you agree with those two paths are possibilities?
I do agree with those two paths, Your Honor. And if I may, as the court said in Cummings, you know, the board decision in that case just provided a notice letter that stated one sentence indicating that the board decision was attached, contained the board decision and the notice of appellate rights. And the Federal Circuit found that that was statutorily compliant with Section 5104 because notice is read as a whole. Similarly, in Mayfield, the court held that the Federal Circuit held that proper notice need not be contained in a single letter and can be cured, as even appellant's counsel recognizes, cured by subsequent notice. And therefore, notice as a whole does not need to be contained in a single letter. Rather, as the secretary contends, notice can be provided both with the notice letter and the enclosures contained therein. And therefore, the question of whether a claimant received proper notice is based on all the information as a whole. And appellant's counsel conceded in response to Judge Falvey's question about whether the rating decision contained the notice requirements of 5104B, stated, I quote, "Of course it's provided in the attached documents, Your Honor." And therefore, the issue is settled in this case as to whether appellant was provided proper notice in this case, Your Honor. It's consistent with both this court's and the Federal Circuit's case law, and it's also consistent with appellant's own acknowledgement during this oral argument.
Could I ask you one more question here? What's odd to me about 5104B, okay, is so the section is set up, the whole section, 5104, is set up with the fundamental premise that there is a decision and then a transmittal, the notice of the decision. And so what's odd is when Congress then says in B, right, that the notice shall contain this list, what's odd to me is if what Congress really meant to do was make sure that those seven things were covered in the decision, I'm just struggling with why Congress wouldn't have said the decision shall contain, right? Because it seemed from my reading of the legislative history that there's not a lot on this provision, right? But there was this a push to say that we're going to give the veterans early notice. And if all that meant was content of a decision, I just would have thought that 5104B would have been written differently. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Your Honor, Congress did not amend Section 5104A, which provides the requirement to provide notice. And Congress, when it set out to improve AOJ notice letters, it necessarily understood what those notices looked like and that they encompassed the rating decisions. And there's no reference in the legislative history or in Congress's amended statute that it wanted to depart from the previous method of providing notice. And therefore, both consistent with prior precedent and on the issue of 5104A regarding the Secretary's duty to provide notice and Congress's failure to amend that language to require a specific standalone requirement for a notice letter, then this court can find and should hold that notice is meant to be read as it always was.
Here's the problem I'm having, which is that the AMA is so starkly different than the other, the pre-existing system, the legacy system. So, for example, I've got two questions I'd like your reaction to. One is one of the hallmark changes is the removal of the statement of the case, right? So we no longer have the what I'm going to call the two-step process, right? You now get the decision, and if you want, you can go right to the board, right? And the statement of the case, of course, was a much more detailed document. So the first question is, so don't we have to give some weight to that? The second question is related, which is, There was a lot of horse trading that went on as part of the development of the AMA, right? Different interest groups gave up different things. And my reading of the legislative history was one of the things that was a give to the veterans for giving up other things like the duty to assist after the original decision was actually this enhanced notice, right? And so if you can speak to both those, the sort of removal of the statement of the case part and then the sort of horse trading point.
Of course, Your Honor. To your first question about the removal of the SOC, Congress did eliminate the SOC, and it did so in part, Your Honor, because it created inefficiencies and redundancies and unnecessary re-adjudications that added significant delays to the appeals process. And when it amended Section 5104B to contain additional notice requirements, that was for the purpose of helping veterans decide whether to appeal the rating decision. But while, although it did include, some of the additional requirements, Your Honor, some of the requirements remained the same. For example, the summary of the evidence remained the same from the previous version. The notice, the duty to provide the notice of appeal rights remained the same. And although it did include the additional provisions, it used generic language like identify and summarize. It did not use, for example, language like analyze or assess. To describe the additional notice, the additional contents of Section 5104. And therefore, the notice in this case does satisfy all those criteria because it contains all the necessary requirements as Appellant's counsel conceded earlier in this argument. And secondly, as to the point about improving the notice, that has been done in this case, Your Honor. In fact, one of the pre-AMA rating decisions in this case only included a three-sentence discussion of the explanation of appellate rights. Whereas, in contrast, the AOJ decision in this case, the January 2019 AOJ decision, contain a one-page discussion of the explanation of appellate rights, and then simultaneously also referenced the ramp review of rights, which was provided with that decision and the notice letter. And therefore, the AOJ letters do provide improved notice as Congress intended, and the AOJ notice in this case does satisfy those criteria.
I was looking at that. That's interesting you'd say that because I want to look at the, I think it's the September 2012 notification letter and compare it to the 2019 notification letter. They're virtually identical. And, one's pre-AMA, the other's post-AMA. If you look at the decisions that were included with them, the 2018 decision does add some discussion of the favorable findings and applicable law regulations and all that, but the actual notification letters are virtually identical. So when I look at that, I say, okay, there was an attempt there to make the rating decision meet the requirements of 5104B. There doesn't appear to be any attempt in the actual notice letter to make the notice letter comply with the new 5104B. Like I said, they look virtually identical to me. Am I wrong?
I disagree to some extent, Your Honor, because the new decision letter, I believe, is approximately 5 or 6 pages long in comparison to, I believe, 2 or 3 pages from the 2012 rating decision. And therefore, it does contain more content, which was in part some of the reasons for amending Section 5104B. But as a whole, Your Honor, the Secretary's always taking the position that notice is both provided via the notice letter and the enclosures. And therefore, to the extent that they remain substantially similar or similar in some respects, notice is still provided in via the rating decision, which does contain all the necessary requirements. And therefore, to the extent that the notice letter does not specifically outline each individual category within the notice letter, it does reference the rating decision, which does contain those. And therefore, the appellants are can be presumed to be on notice of the information contained in the rating decision.
Maybe I overstated when I said they're virtually identical. They're very similar. In their actual content. It's your position then, the notice, what's important here is, was there actual notice of each of the elements in 5104B, and that in essence what Mr. Cowell and Mr. Carpenter is arguing is that notice should be kind of a strict liability thing. If it's not in the actual notice letter, whether we had actual notice of the various provisions or the various aspects of the decision is irrelevant. It's got to be in the notice letter. Is that the distinction between the two, your argument and Mr. Carpenter's?
We obviously disagree with appellant's counsel's argument, and we also disagree that actual notice is required through the notice letters and rating decisions. All that the statute requires is that the secretary provides notice, and that the AOJ notice letters provide notice. It's done for the purpose of enabling veterans to choose the right options for them, and to just be able to determine whether to appeal a rating decision. And therefore, actual notice doesn't need to be proven by the secretary. But well, it is our position, Your Honor.
We can't read the recipient's mind and determine whether they actually read that paragraph and all and everything. But I'm saying the content of the notice package met all of the requirements of 5104A and B. And if that's actually there, then notice was provided, sufficient notice was provided. Whereas Mr. Cowan's argument is it's got to be in the notice letter and doesn't matter if it's in an attachment.
That is correct, Your Honor. It is our position that notice can be provided through the rating decision and attachment and not simply through the notice letter. Ultimately, Your Honor, this court should reject appellant's position that to impute a detailed description requirement in virtually every element of Section 5104, because that's simply contrary to the plain language of the statute. Notably, Section 5104's command to provide an explanation of the procedure for obtaining review remains the same as it did in 1998. And similarly, although Congress added more elements to subsection B, as I mentioned earlier, it did not require a detailed description of those requirements. That same position was made in
your argument would be no different if Congress had said you must provide a detailed explanation, right? Your argument would still be we can incorporate the rating decision, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what about this? We've all been proceeding, and I don't want to lump everybody in with the slow me, but that basically what this would be a repetition, right? In other words, why would Congress have done something so silly as to say, clone what was in the rating decision and put it in the notice letter, because then you'd be getting two decisions, right? But what about this? So when I was looking at this, I was intrigued by what kind of favorable findings might have been made in the rating decision. And when I first went to look, one of the things that struck me was they're not all in the same place. There's more than one place in which they, with no bolded headings or anything, say we've made the favorable findings. They do it for different claims. Why wouldn't it be consistent with this idea of Congress wanting to provide notice to veterans to, for example, just as an example, have the notice letter say, we have, as part of our decision on your claims, we have made certain favorable findings. They're located at pages 6 and 13 of the attached rating decision, right? Because that would then flag that as something that is important because Congress says it's important. It would not require a duplication of what's in the main rating decision, and it wouldn't inject uncertainty about a Scrivener's error, right? So why wouldn't something like that have been a middle ground? Because I agree with Judge Falvey, the letters are nearly identical, pre-AMA and post-AMA.
Well, Your Honor, page 835 of the record does contain a very specific part of the decision that says favorable findings. And therefore,
I'm telling you, there's more than one place that there are favorable findings, right? But my point is, if you just read the notice letter, a letter that under 5104B4, right, Congress specifically mandated this, be said shall in the notice, you could read the notice letter and you would never know that there had been favorable findings made, right? And my point is, if Congress marked this out, we don't have to say that the secretary would have had to duplicate what it did in the decision to do it twice. It could have just flagged the issue, right?
Well, I disagree that the notice letter itself does not indicate that favorable findings.
Okay,
are made
all right. Because well, it does... wait, we're back to that. I would like you to point me to the record page in which somebody could read the notice letter and know that VA rendered a favorable finding consistent with 5104B4.
Well, Your Honor, the rating decision on page
804. Not the rating decision.
No, I bought
the letter. You just said to me, again, going back to what you said at the beginning, that the notice letter says something about this. I could be wrong. I have old eyes, so I could have simply missed it. If there is something in the notice letter that you think complies with 5104B4, then you should tell me the page so I can look at it when the argument is done, right? I think your position is you're looking too narrowly. You should look at the rating decision and I can cite you the rating decision, and that's fine. That might be right as a matter of law. I'm just trying to get that you really don't believe that there's something that's compliant with 5104B4 in the notice letter.
Well, Your Honor, appellants obviously understand or have an understanding of how their ratings have changed over the course of time. And in the What We Decided section of the AOJ notice letter, it does state what the previous evaluation was for the condition and what the new ratings for the condition are.
So Mr. Petrelli, your unwillingness to say what is reality, actually, I'm just telling you, actually for me is troubling. And here's why it's troubling, right? Because it's not just that somebody knows that there's a favorable finding made, but Congress did something else, right? It said when anybody at the agency makes a favorable finding, it then will bind forever unless there's a clear and unmistakable error, right? Right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, if you're trying to say that you can read the notice letter, and if I see something there that looks favorable, that complies with the favorable finding, that becomes really problematic then, doesn't it? Because then that suggests that we're going to be parsing later in time what things will forever bind the agency, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Without there actually being something in the notice letter that says favorable, we've made these favorable findings, you're left somebody, you're making people guess about what is or is not going to bind the agency down the road.
That is potentially a risk, Your Honor, but the evidence in this case, you know, this case has been pending for 10 years, and appellant has not pointed to a single favorable finding that's been made by the AOJ or the board that has not been effectuated by either the AOJ or the board. In fact, the board in its recitation of the history of this case identified the different changes of the ratings and only considered the ratings that were over and above that. I understand your point about it would potentially be better to have everything listed in the notice letter. Here's the favorable finding that was made. It's located on this page. But the statute doesn't require that, Your Honor. It simply requires an identification of the favorable finding.
But I want to go back. So But you maintain that this notice letter standing alone is sufficient so that later in time, somebody would be able to look at the notice letter and say, oh, this finding is binding on VA for all time unless we show clear and unmistakable error.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. No, I don't believe that it adequately states every single favorable finding. I hope that answers your
question. Yes, and you can still win by saying that, right? That's what I'm trying to get you to understand, right? Okay. So that's important. Judge Fowler.
Can I jump in?
You may jump in with both feet.
Thank you. So let's assume we agree with you that the notice letter by itself is inadequate to meet the requirements of 5104. We could then look at the decision, though, and say the decision, too, doesn't meet the requirements of 5104 for some reason, right? And then what? It's like equivalent of a reasons or bases remand at that point?
I don't believe I understood your question, Judge Favre. Would you mind repeating it or rephrasing
it? Sure. Let's when we look at the totality of the communication, we can still find it wanting in some respect. In that it, let's use the favorable findings one, that it inadequately provides the information regarding the favorable findings. It didn't flag it adequately enough. It was dispersed through the decision, the rating decision. What would we do with that then? I send it back to the board that its reasons or bases for finding the notice adequate was inadequately explained. It was a reasons or bases type remand.
Your Honor, I believe, if I understood
the board, the board either needs to explain it better or send it back for additional notice, I guess.
I believe if I understood your question correctly, Your Honor, we would be addressing as a factual matter whether it provided adequate notice and or I guess if we'd already determined that it did not, then whether there was prejudice to the appellant. And in this case, a simple comparison of appellant's contentions following the AOJ decision shows that appellant was informed and had a meaningful opportunity to participate in the proceedings, which is precisely the purpose, you know, behind the improved AOJ notices. In fact, after the appellant argued in his...
assume for the sake of argument that we think that there's prejudice. What do we do then? Do we remand it as a reasons or basis remand?
And before you answer, Dawn, you can answer.
5 minutes when the time expires.
Your Honor, we would have to look at the sequence of events after the AOJ decision, whether there was any prejudice found in the board decision. Simply there is not, Your Honor. In fact, after the 2019, after the January 2019 AOJ notice letter,
I want you to assume that we got beyond that and that we determined that there was prejudice.
If I understood your question, Your Honor, prejudice in the AOJ notice letter?
In the absence of the information in the rating decision, prejudice, Mr. Cowan. We've gotten beyond that. Now we're to the point now. Okay, we agree with the secretary that it can be, it's the totality of the notice package, and that yet the rating decision somehow lacked one of these elements of 5104, and Mr. Cowan was prejudiced by that lack. What do we do with that? I'm assuming we remand.
I
remand for what?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Remand for what? What are we remanding for the board to then do?
Well, that's precisely the point, Your Honor. I guess the court could remand for the AOJ to issue a clearer notice of favorable findings. But again, if, as in this case, the matters are even decided by a board decision, the court would have to look at the board decision to see if there is any prejudice reflected in the overall outcome of, I believe, the proceeding. But assuming there's no board decision, Your Honor, I believe that the course of action would be to remand for improved notice in this case, but it's reviewed on a case by case basis, Your Honor. As I was mentioning, Your Honor, I don't believe that there was prejudice in this case because appellant showed an understanding of what the issues were, what was adjudicated, and what his favorable findings were, to include, for example, that he received a 50% rating under DEC 5256. And he argued in his September 2019 board NOD that he was seeking separate ratings altogether for five different conditions, not specifically that would give him a higher rating overall, more so than he was previously receiving. Thus, his 11-page board NOD shows at a minimum that he had sufficient information in this case. But I would like to move on to my second point, Your Honors, that Congress did not intend for Section 5104 to apply to the board when it amended the statute. As previously noted, Congress enacted the AMA to eliminate the excessive delays associated with the legacy system that added years to the appeals process and resulted in veterans waiting years for...
Let me hop in here. So it's your position that a board decision is not a decision of the Secretary?
That's correct, Your Honor. If Congress intended that the terms of decision by the Secretary under Section 511 to encompass AOJ decisions and board decisions, then it would have consistently used the term the Secretary to encompass both.
What would the board be then? Would it be something like an independent agency within VA? I mean, what exactly would board members be if they're not under the purview of the Secretary and under the direction of the Secretary?
Well, the board is an appellate body within the VA, Your Honor, and its duties are to conduct appellate reviews of decisions by the Secretary, and that's reflected under Section 7104 that indicates, that states that board decisions are appellate reviews of decisions by the Secretary. In other words, the Secretary's decision, although the board does fall within the general parameter of the Department of Veterans Affairs, the board's decisions are separate and apart from the Secretary's decisions, and as reflected in Section 7104, the Secretary's decision has already occurred prior to the board's review of that decision. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor. May I have a few more minutes?
Yeah, we'll add 5 more minutes so you can completely answer Judge Cho's questions and say what else you'd like to say about the board argument.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Judge Allen. And this reading is supported by the Federal Circuit's decision in Bates, Your Honor, which held that Section 511 places review of secretarial decisions first in the board and then in the court. This reflects, as I was explaining, Your Honor, that the board is an appellate body within a VA and not necessarily, and that its decisions are not decisions by the Secretary. In fact, the distinctive use of appeal rather than decision in Section 7104 is telling because Congress could have simply ended that first sentence of Section 7104 with another decision by the Secretary.
The Secretary can delegate or sub-delegate like multiple layers, right? And so they could have you know, somebody make the original decision and then they could delegate to a different party the review of that decision, right? But that still happens under the purview of the Secretary. I mean, they're still what I think in constitutional terms they call inferior officers, right? I mean, they're appointed by the secretary to carry out the work of the secretary, right?
I, if I understood your question correctly, I believe that's correct, Your Honor. However, the distinction between who is conducting or who is making the decision is what's important under Section 7504 and Section 7104 for purposes of Section 511. The distinctive use of appeal in Section 7104, which would apply those provisions to board decisions rather than the general decision by the secretary found in Section 5104, indicates there are different processes that occur at different points in time within BA. And because the board is an appellate body and because Section 7104 does reference procedures based on appellate review of decisions by the secretary, Congress clearly drew a distinction between decisions of the secretary and appeals to appellate reviews by the board of those decisions.
Mr. Cattrall, Judge Valve, you can go first. It looked like you were going to ask.
Thank you. Is there any provisions in law, either in 38 or elsewhere, that allow the secretary to overrule the board?
The secretary can reconsider its own decisions, Your Honor. But the secretary can't, for example, review or initiate an appeal of a favorable finding made by the board. I hope that answers your question. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
I'm just wondering if that you're making the distinction between decisions of the secretary and review of those decisions. If the secretary could then review the reviewer's decision and issue a new decision or a different decision, that would seem to indicate that that board decisions are decisions of the secretary. So I'm asking, is there any provisions that allow the secretary to do that, to review the decisions of the reviewer, the board? Other than the board reconsideration, which is by the chairman, and this.
No, I don't believe that there is, Your Honor. But Congress's intent to distinguish between decisions and actions of the secretary and the board, Your Honor, I should rephrase. Congress altered the purpose of Section 504 through the enactments of the AMA, and it did so by distinguishing and referencing two secretary decisions as AOJ decisions, and also distinguishing between decisions of the secretary and the board. For example, in Section 5103A(e)(1).
Before you get to that, this follows on Judge Falvey's point, but. And don't worry about the time, answer the question. It is, so you agree, you know, put aside the incorporation points we've been talking about, okay? You agree that a favorable finding identified by the agency of original jurisdiction binds the agency then going forward under 5104 capital A, right?
Yes, I believe that's correct, John.
So the oddity of this, your position though, is that the a frontline adjudicator sitting in St. Petersburg can render a decision that it calls a favorable finding that will bind the agency for time immemorial under 5104 capital A. But then 5104 capital A doesn't apply to the board because 5104 capital A specifically refers to B4 of the notice of 5104, right?
Well, Section 504... Section 5104A says department, Your Honor. So it does, if I have it.
No, what it says is It says any finding favorable to the claimant as described in section 5104B4 of this title shall be binding on all subsequent adjudicators within the department unless clear and convincing evidence is shown to the contrary, right? So it refers to the department going forward. So the oddity of this to me, though, is that the person sitting in their office in the St. Pete regional office can render a finding that is favorable that will bind the agency forever, right, going forward, unless there's clear and convincing evidence to the contrary. But that same rule doesn't apply to the board. So how do we wrestle with that?
Well, Your Honor, the 5104A does say department, not the secretary.
No. It says on all subsequent, right? But it applies only to favorable findings, it says, under 5104B4. Your position, the secretary's position, is that does not apply to the board, right? So that would mean, I'm just trying to wrestle with whether, you know, does this oddity that I'm describing as an oddity suggest that there might be a problem with the interpretation, that the initial adjudicator can render a favorable finding that will bind the department forever, subject to the error point, but the highest level of administrative review, something that it may be that the secretary can never even reverse, couldn't do that. That just seems like an oddity to me.
Well, the secretary can do that, Your Honor. In fact, the secretary has promulgated 20.801 for that purpose, and it's well established that board findings are for
what purpose?
For the purpose of binding AOJs to favorable findings made by the board. And that's already a long-standing principle that's governed this court's case law for a long time. The RO can't essentially overturn a decision by the board. It can only be reversed by the board.
What about the board? I mean, what about the board, right? Because if the board says something in decision A, right, it makes a favorable finding, let's say, right, not under the new provision, but just it says something favorable. The board could later change that if it provided sufficient reasons or bases, right? But it couldn't if in fact B4 applies to the board, unless it particularly found clear and convincing evidence that the earlier finding was wrong. Do you see what I'm getting at there?
It could, based on CUE, Your Honor. Yes, that's correct. You know, both, if I understood correctly, Your Honor, 20.801 does say that AOJ findings are binding on the board, and the board does acknowledge that, but Congress does not create a separate statute for that purpose, but the Secretary has used his broad authority under Section 501 to promulgate such authority. In doing so, Your Honor, Congress has distinguished between the AOJ and the board in other respects that indicate that Section 5104 does not apply to the board. For example, in amended Section 5103A(e)(1), and newly enacted Section 5104C(1), demonstrate that a decision by the secretary under Section 5104 is an AOJ decision. For example, Section 5104C says that in any case in which the secretary renders a decision on the claim, the claimant may take certain review options, any of the appeal options listed under that section, including higher level review, board appeal, and a supplemental claim. But through the AMA, the high level review and board appeal are not options at the board level. And therefore, Congress was clearly distinguishing between procedures that apply at the board and the AOJ, and clearly intended for an AOJ decision to be the secretary's decision. Similarly, Your Honor, Congress amended Section 5103A to provide that the Secretary's duty to assist under the section shall not apply to reviews on appeal by the Board of and if Congress intended for the terms of Secretary as found in Section 511 to mean the Board or for those terms to be essentially interchangeable, then it would have simply ended that sentence with review on appeal by the Secretary, which would have resulted in the identical language found in Section 511. But instead, Congress made a distinction between a decision of the Secretary and decision of the Board.
Mr. Petrelli, subject to either Judge Toth or Judge Falvey having additional questions, why don't we try to wrap up a little bit now, summarize your argument?
Of course, Your Honor. If I may, just a couple more points. You know, Congress clearly intended to exclude the terms of decision of the Secretary as further shown by the simultaneous enactment of Section 5109A and Section 7111, which deal with revisions on the grounds of CUE. If decisions of the Secretary were meant to be inclusive of decisions of the Board, then Congress would not have simultaneously enacted separate statutes to govern revisions of those decisions because Section 5109A would have been sufficient under Section 511. But because Congress did draw that distinction, it clearly shows that Congress did intend for decisions of the Secretary to be different from decisions of the Board. Lastly, Your Honor, just as a final point, Congress clearly expressed its intent regarding Section 5104 when the House Committee on Veterans Affairs issued its report accompanying the bill that became the AMA, stating that the intent of Section 5104B is to help better inform the veterans' decisions regarding whether to appeal VA's rating decision. Therefore, Congress clearly expressed its intent that the amendments to Section 5104 were for the AOJ. And throughout the course of those discussions and negotiations with the VSO and other parties, it did not reference any adjustment to the Board's notices of its decisions. And therefore, Your Honor, we respectfully ask that the Court affirm the Board's decision and find that Section 5104 does not apply to Board decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Cotrelli. Mr. Carpenter, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. To please the Court, I have several points to make in rebuttal, but let me start first with the Secretary's regulation at 20.801. The second full sentence of that regulation states as follows: any findings favorable to the claimant as identified by the agency of original jurisdiction in notification of a decision or in a prior Board decision on an issue on appeal are binding on all agency of original jurisdiction and Board of Veterans Appeals adjudicators unless rebutted. It seems to me, Your Honor, that the Secretary's own regulation treats the findings of fact made by the Board and made by AOJ adjudicators as being decisions of the Secretary. And it simply undermines the government's argument that there is a distinction here. I'd like to move now to what I consider to be the fatal flaw in the government's position in this appeal. The government's position overlooks on both issues the mandate of 5104 capital C, which is to provide options after an AOJ decision. And once the AOJ makes a decision or a Board makes a decision, options are now available. On AOJ decisions, those options include filing a request for higher level review, making a supplemental claim with new and relevant evidence, or taking an appeal. The harm to Mr. Callum is that without notice from the AOJ of its RAMPS decisions compliance with 5104B. Mr. Cowan and his attorney were hamstrung by not knowing what those findings of fact were, and knowing, as this court has suggested in its question to the government, whether or not those findings purported to have been made in different places in the rating decision were in fact intended to be binding, because no notice as required by 5104B informed Mr. Cowan of that fact. On the second level, as to the question of the board decision and whether it is a decision which must include 5104B notice, I direct the court's attention to the secretary's regulation at 2.5000, parens C, parens 3, in which the secretary clearly indicates that the option is available after a final decision under this new appellate process to either file a supplemental claim with new and relevant evidence or take an appeal to this court. Without the compliant notice provided by the board, how does the veteran and his representative make an informed decision? They need to know each of the seven requirements of specific content in the statute be provided in order to make that informed decision, or the veteran is in the position that Mr. Cowan's in. He had to appeal because he didn't know whether those findings of fact that were favorable were or were not adopted by the board, whether the board considered them to be bound. They would have known that had the board provided compliant notice. And that is the fundamental flaw with the government's argument in this case. I'd like to address for a moment, if I may, Judge Falvey's question about remand and the question of remedy in this case and sending it back to the board. The problem, Judge Falvey, in my view, is the position that the VA takes relative to the board's jurisdiction following its decisions, including decisions following remand from this court. The secretary's position is that the appellate process ends, and under the AMA, the claimant must start anew. The board interprets, as I understand it, their jurisdiction to prevent them from remanding except for duty to assist errors. And therefore, a remand from this court to them with instructions to remand for proper notice would be a non-starter for the board. What this court needs to do is to recognize that what is being presented in this appeal is a question of law as to the meaning of the mandatory requirements under 5104. And if they are not complied with, then the decision of RAMP was never final and the board didn't have jurisdiction. And this court must so find and set aside the board's decision as unlawful based upon its misinterpretation of 5104 and the notice requirements, and order them to return the matter to the board or to the agency of original jurisdiction to provide compliant notice. That is the only way that it works, at least under the current interpretation of the secretary. One final comment before I end.
Let me ask you a question about that. So yes, are you saying that, you know, I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing.
Yes.
If we disagree with you that the notice has to be standalone, mm-hmm. yet we find the notice inadequate as contained in the rating decision.
Yes.
What can we do with that? Are you saying if we remand that to the board, we can't do that with an instruction that they send it back to the AOJ for?
It is my understanding of prior decisions by the board in cases in which I have been the representative that the board does not believe that it has jurisdiction to remand anything to the agency of original jurisdiction other than duty to assist error.
Okay. Okay.
And this would not be a duty to assist error, nor would it be a reasons or bases error. It would have been a clear error of law.
Well, only if we agree with you that it has to be in the actual letter.
No, Your Honor, because even if you didn't, if you agreed that it could be provided within that, it was a legal error, an error of law in not providing compliant notice. And the failure to provide compliant notice rendered, as the colloquy that Judge Allen and I had, that these decisions would be rendered non-final. If they're not final, then there is no basis to file an NOD. And so
although, Mr. Carpenter, we could, I think, to follow up on Judge Falvey's point, I think you're right, at least anecdotally from information I've heard from different people at different events, right, that in fact this is the way the board is proceeding on these types of AMA claims. But if we were to find the notice deficient, even if we rejected your argument, we just say, even if you read all of this together, this notice is not compliant. And we remanded a different way to articulate what you're saying, at least as I hear it, is we then need to just be expressly clear and exceedingly directive that this is how the board shall implement our decision on remand, right? In other words, put it into the supplemental claim lane. This notice was deficient, hypothetically. Remand to the agency of original jurisdiction to issue compliant notice consistent with the terms of this decision or something like that.
And my concern is that I will be back here before this court on behalf of Mr. Cowan to say that the board is refusing to enforce this court's order.
4 years from now.
Quite possibly, Your Honor.
Hopefully, understood.
I will still be here.
Judge Toth, do you have anything else?
Sorry, I was looking for the mute button. I do not. Thanks to everybody.
Judge Falvey?
Just a couple of housekeeping things here. So if we find the notice is compliant, you have, in fact, abandoned all your other arguments, right?
Well, Your Honor, my position is that they have not been abandoned because there was no final decision to present them.
But if we find the notice compliant.
But if you find the notice compliant, I have presented no other arguments on the merits because of the underlying assumption that there was no final decision to submit those.
Okay. And my last question, was I correct when I was talking to the Secretary's counsel that your position is that the notice is required to be in the standalone document, and if it's lacking, then it's, you know, strict That's liability true. Per se violation
as a matter of law. Absolutely, Your Honor, right. that you correctly understand our position.
Great.
And I believe that's consistent with the plain language of the statute.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I have nothing further.
Well, thanks to both parties for putting up with all our questions and staying after school, so to speak. We appreciate it on this challenging and an important case. And with that, the case is submitted.
And the court is in recess.